applaud you for your bravery getting up. By the end of this week, they'll have the most sleep deprived they've ever been in the last 20 years.
Excluding the last five conferences.
I don't remember them.
That is because...
We're going to open up the day today with a rousing call to arms. Of all people, who would have expected a biologist to do this? Well, there's many personalities to Jeff Schrader. And amongst them is the fact that we must admit our applications is what have driven us from the beginning, from Maxima to the expert systems and on down the line. Biolingua, ontolingua, that's a field for us. So here we go, guys. How LISP is going to save us.
Save the world, not just us.
Wow, thank you.
We're irrelevant. The world's what's important. I think this is going to be probably a bit heavy for 8 a.m., and so I apologize in advance. If people want to just kind of go to sleep, I actually, believe it or not, wrote this out, so I can email it to you so everyone can just go home and sleep. Let's see. So some of you probably remember the ILC 2002 performance where I gave this Fast and Furious talk about biology, and it was very abstract, and I kind of talked about all these sort of bioinformatic applications and this, and blah, blah, blah. I tend to use symbolic computing and this kind of interchangeably, and you can read whichever one you want into it, or some other version of, you know, half-grown implementation of this with the symbolic computing. This time I'm going to be much more detailed and give some specific reasons, and actually a specific reasoned argument why symbolic computing is going to save the world. And so I'd like to start out with a little simulation demonstration. I wish Gabriel could have done his little thing with key genes today, because in fact that was exactly what I was going to do. I'm doing it with a different system. So I'm going to start by simulating the conclusion of a biology talk. All right. So you have to imagine that you've watched an entire boring talk at 8 a.m. with data, you know, mind-numbing data and pictures and methodology and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if you've ever seen a biology talk where they're sort of mind-numbingly boring. Usually. And then the conclusion is this rousing description. And I'm going to do this for you. Okay, this is the diagram. So in conclusion, we think that this model sums up our findings. Homologous desensitization of GPCRs results from binding beta arrestins to agonist-occupied receptors. Following phosphorylation, is like a game point, following phosphorylation of the receptor by GRKs, you can, if I had a laser pointer, I could, you know, do the problem. You'll get the idea. Beta arrestin binding sterically precludes coupling between the receptor and the heteromeric G proteins, leading to termination of signaling by G protein effectors. Receptor bound beta arrestins also act as adaptive proteins. Of course, I would know this if this were my theory. Binding to components of the clathrin endocytic machinery, including clathrin, beta, adaptin 2. Receptor sequestration reflects the dynamin-dependent endocytosis, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to do the whole thing for you. I could do the whole thing. Any questions? I will do it again. There's going to be a quiz in 15 minutes, actually. So,
could you summarize that in the LISP program, please?
I will. So the topic of the talk, on the topic of the talk, how LISP will save the world. So the last 50 years of the last century, actually the last 50 years from now, approximately since the discovery of DNA, was the golden age of biological data, where high-throughput technologies such as genome sequencing, microarrays, all those other kinds of good things you know about, have created an enormous amount of data that's collected. Approximately, believe it or not, 4,000 genomes have been sequenced in the National Center of Biotech Information, the NCBI, something you probably know about. And this is a growth of the graph of GenBank sequences since, you know, whenever, to, I guess it probably, I don't actually know where the 2002 ends. Oh, 2004, okay. So we're, you know, upwards of 50 billion base pairs in the database, and a biologist would call this the exponential growth phase. So this is the lag phase and the log phase. Yeah, right, exactly. What's the doubling?
What caused the kickoff hockey stick? Did it change in technology?
Essentially sequencing machines. Automatic sequencing. So of course there are other types of data. Now this is eventually going to level off. Right? In fact, it'll probably level off pretty soon, just the sequences, but there's just starting to be all kinds of other automatic data collected. Flow cytometry, microscopy, pictures of various sorts, three-dimensional protein stuff. And this data will continue to be collected, but Whereas the last century was the century, what you might call the century of biological data, the next century, this century, is going to for sure to be the golden age of biological knowledge. In on 6-7, when I accessed this, there were 15,596,125 abstracts in the PubMed database. Now that doesn't sound like a big number if you compare it with Google's 8 billion, but the signal-to-noise ratio of Google is essentially zero. And the signal-to-noise ratio of this is essentially one. In fact, pretty much everything in Google that isn't noise is just a copy of PubMed. or porn. And that's your definition of noise, of course. So whereas the number of sequences will probably level off, the knowledge, that is the sort of interpretations of all this data, is sure to continue going on. As you get more data, you get more interpretations of data. So every piece of data has like 20 interpretations. And so there's more interpretation of the data than there is data. For fun, I entered an obscure organism, the cyanobacteria, which I had a picture of in the previous slide, into the PubMed database. And you had, again, I certainly need to later point for this, but you'll be able to find it if I say it. Oh, I can point. Sort of. There are, it's not very efficient, and I'll accidentally push the buttons, I'm not going to do it. There are 42 sequence genomes. This is just cyanobacteria, okay? There are 42 sequence, which is a bacteria. Okay, there are 42 sequence genomes, 1,000 3D domains, that's protein, those protein folding solutions, almost 9,000 papers. This is basically ocean scum, right? So there are 9,000 papers on ocean scum. So here's electron microscopy of some ocean scum. This is Prochlorococcus. Notice that this ocean scum on which there are 9,000 papers is less than a micron in diameter. Right. Although those papers have data, their conclusions constitute what you would call knowledge, and the knowledge comes usually in the form of models. Right? That is, partial hypotheses about what's going on in a biological system, very often inside single cells, like these single cells. And a model, of course, is just a formal representation that can be used by a computer to simulate and analyze the system under study. My central claim is that in order to keep up with this flood of knowledge, biologists must become accustomed to using what we call, what has been called by others before, tools for thought to build and analyze models of this sort. Now, there's a tradition in engineering of developing and analyzing formal models, most often represented by systems of differential equations. This is a model due to Chen. The analysis of such models is usually done with tools, you might call them tools for thought, such as MATLAB. This is an example. So this Chen model is of yeast budding, and for what it's worth, here's the dynamics of the model. And for what it's worth, it shows some sort of vague qualitative similarity to yeast budding, like the yeast buds. Right? The timing, I don't know whether the qualitative is similar to the timing of the yeast budding. I won't go through this particular model. It took about 10 years, I don't know the exact time, it's hard to tell from the publication, but there's 10 years worth of publications refining this model. Right? So they basically built it by hand, parameterized it by hand, and published it over and over in different versions. It's very good, by the way, I don't want to criticize this model, it's actually a brilliant, brilliant, important piece of work. However, and it looks extremely complex, however, the abstract model, that is, the players in the kind of qualitative model here, isn't that complex. It only involves a few players. And of course, you can find hundreds of these kinds of models if you just flip through biological literature. And now there are, of course, being specialized databases for these kinds of abstract models, as well as for differential equation models. If a model is written as a set of parameterized differential equations, then simulation is relatively easy. As we saw, essentially, we know how to simulate linear differential equations. You stick it in MATLAB or something. And there's a whole project called BioSpice. Some of you may know about SPICE, the electrical system simulator. So there's a BioSpice project. The idea of BioSpice is actually to take models which are systems of differential equations that represent chemical reactions and, simulate them. Right? And BioSpice is a very big project. There's another project, there's like an SBNL, systems biology. You can imagine what the NL is. And essentially, they're all, trying to kind of do this sort of thing. There are a lot of people working on that stuff. But the key point is that all of these things work primarily in these models that range over quantitative variables. Right? Unfortunately, this quantitative modeling approach falls short in biology for at least three reasons. First, biological data is incredibly expensive. So I usually talk about signal-to-noise per dollar ratio in biology because it's so incredibly expensive. I mean, you would not believe how expensive it is in people time and, you might get 10 data points from going to see for you know, months in a ship, millions of dollars per data point. I actually asked somebody once in geobiology what the data points were for this talk, and it was like millions of dollars a data point. So the second reason is the biological systems are not like engineered systems. Okay. Engineered systems need to operate robustly under certain constrained conditions. Those conditions can be specified, the model is analyzed under those conditions. For example, we know that a bridge has to stand up. This is my favorite slide. We know the bridge has to stand up to have cars go over it. It doesn't have to do both that and fly at, you know, 40,000 feet at, you know, at 10 miles an hour or whatever it is. I know it's 40,000 feet, 700 miles an hour, carrying 300 people, I think, is the example I gave you. But biological systems actually operate under many different conditions. And this was actually part of Gabriel's point yesterday, is that the systems, you know, spend a lot of their time trying to figure out how to manage themselves under all kinds of different circumstances. They're, in a sense, much more robust than engineered systems. Unfortunately, we know how to analyze engineered systems. We don't know how to analyze the biological systems. So, you know, Gabriel, I love Gabriel's talk. I could have used sort of video of him in parts here. In any case, So they have different logic in the system for different conditions. So this is sort of what we're talking about with junk DNA yesterday. This is from BioSplice. It's not actually something simulated by BioSplice, but it's the regulatory logic for, this isn't yeast, but it's some other organism, Bacillus body. So this, don't worry about what's on this, but essentially it's a logical diagram. It's a logical description rather than it's sort of what things are turning, what switches are turning other switches on and off, right? Now, that kind of thing is very hard to model with simple differential equations. In fact, you can model it with nonlinear differential equations, but then we don't know how to actually simulate it. And in any case, you can't parameterize them. So we don't have enough data. We can't do operating logics with those kinds of linear differential equations. And the third reason, and this is the most important of the reasons, is that they fail to offer the kind of expressive power that biologists want. Biologists want to understand how the system works, not just its I/O behavior, right? And the problem is that the system doesn't. No, I'm getting ahead of myself. They want to know how the system works at the level of biochemical machine. That is, what all the proteins and nucleic acids and small molecules do, how they interact to make the cell function. So we'll go back to this thing. Now, one might say, oh well, you want a model of the chemistry, right? We know how to do that. The chemical reactions. We saw that. That's BioSplice chemistry. And then you're back to BioSplice, but it isn't so simple. First off, yes, reaction dynamics are easy to express, but hard to parameterize, right? If you don't have a lot of data, you can't figure out what the parameters are. If you can't figure out what the parameters are, you're essentially no one. Excuse me. Second, again, the system is very, very complex. So complex, in fact, that some serious, albeit broken, biologists think that cellular systems, and I really mean cellular systems, not all biology, are proof of God, right? In fact, this is one of the fundamental tenets of intelligent design, is not all biological systems, but just cellular systems are proof of God, right? It just could not have, it's so complex that it could not have actually been evolved. So we really only know how to express the sorts of things that chemical equations do, and maybe some other, you know, relatively simple things. And we're neglecting conformation and all the kinds of things that play in the cell. Finally, and here's the kicker, biologists actually don't want an explanation of biology in these terms. That is, they want it on their own terms. Well, what are their terms? What terms do they think in? What kind of terms do they actually want the explanation in? Well, they want it in machine-like terms. They want it in terms of parts, processes, dynamics, and operating logic. How do you get, so those are the things, how you get the states I was talking about into this. Some of these process dynamics are simple biochemistry, but most of them are not. Take DNA, right? So how DNA is transcribed to RNA, which I'm going to assume most of you know about, is called gene expression. This is from the PDB, which is the protein database, which is essentially the most authoritative database for storing three-dimensional conformation solutions to proteins. Right, so you're about to see stuff that people who do the protein science write. Okay, no one talks about gene expression in biochemical terms. Well, I guess if you're a chemist of these things, you might. Of course, they know it's a biochemical process, but it turns out that's like a psychologist knowing the brain is made of neurons. It's the wrong level. So I'll show you the way they talk about this system. Right? So RNA polymerase is a huge factory with many moving parts. The one shown here is from cell PDB, actually. If you push that button, you get the actual three-dimensional picture. It's from yeast. It's composed of a dozen different parts. They form a machine that surrounds DNA strands, unwinds them, builds the RNA strand. I mean, you guys know all this, but my point here is that biologists actually talk this way. Right? It's not like they just teach this way. They actually talk and think this way. If you wrote down the differential equations for this, God forbid you could, right? Then you wouldn't be interested in it. They go, well, you know, I don't know, which part of this is pulling the machine through, right? So this brings me back, of course, to the quiz. All right, remember I said we'd come back to this, you wanted to see it again, here it is again. So I'm gonna do a piece of it, and this time look for the parts, the processes, the operating logics, and whatever the other thing was. Parts, processes, dynamics, and operating logics. I'll just do the first half. Homologous desensitization of GPCRs, don't worry about what they are, results from the binding of beta arrestins, which is somewhere up there, beta arrestins bind, to agonist-occupied receptors. So the receptor is already occupied by something else. Should be an antagonist. Following phosphorylation of the receptors by GRKs. I don't know. Beta arrestin binding sterically precludes coupling between the receptor and the heteromeric G proteins, whatever they are, leading to termination of signaling by G protein effectors. Okay, receptor-bound arrestins also act as adaptive proteins, blah, 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 blah. Okay. There's actually a piece of operating. I mean, you can sort of rewrite this as a machine description, not as a bunch of differential equations, although perhaps algebraic topology would be part of it. In any case, so forth, so on, so forth. You get the idea. Put that in your differential equation simulator, Ryan. Now, this came from, someone asked where this came from. This came from something called BioCarta. It's just a picture. We don't have ways of writing this stuff down yet, but what I'm arguing is we need ways to write this. Stuff. I'll show you a few more things from BioCarta. BioCarta, by the way, has 400 pathways that are just pictures like this in the descriptions. This one, unfortunately, oh, I can read it right here. Huh. This one has to do with what we were talking about before, which is protein translation, turning the RNA into the protein. The interesting thing to watch in these BioCarta things is the arrows, right? So the arrows have all kinds of different meanings, depending on what's going on. So like this, these arrows up here are things going into the, you know, going in through the cell wall, and this arrow here is, I don't even know what it is, something coming off, something decoupling from the DNA, and they have great pictures, right? All these things, here's a great one. DNA nicks and then it fragments, right? So this is like an incredibly complicated process, et cetera. So I won't show you a lot of these. I mean, I'll show you a lot of these. This is the cell cycle is drawn as this arrow, right? I mean, like the arrows have, I don't know what the difference between blue arrows and red arrows and stuff. In any case, you can go through, there's no consistency. I mean, people just draw them the way they want them. They try and kind of make the arrows consistent. This is a great one where those arrows are light coming in and damaging the DNA, and then, you know, that signals something which does something, and, you know, and somehow proteasm is involved in any case. Oh, that was that apoptosis? Now, one of them was what Gabriel talked about, apoptosis. This is viruses. This arrow is the virus injecting the thing in. So the arrows, the arrows represent processes that these biologists just think is going on, right?
What confidence do they have that this is meaningful?
They have high confidence in little tiny bits of it.
In the sense that they don't have a machine to simulate it.
Right, so we'll get to that.
So,
okay, we'll get to that. This is, again, the biospice operating logic. And this is photosynthesis, which we'll get back to, actually. So photosynthesis has... you know, you think of it as something that just absorbs light, creates sugar, and finds carbon dioxide and things like that. But in fact, if you draw it out the way that biologists think about it, you've got all these different subsystems absorbing light, and they're splitting water over there and creating hydrogen, you know, protons. The protons are on this side of the membrane. They create a proton pressure in that. The protons go through this thing, which is an ATP. It rotates a little thing on the top, which actually connects phosphate to ADP, making so adenosine diphosphate, to make ATP, adenosine triphosphate, bam, right? Puts it on, passes it on, right? And in fact, they've done experiments where they put little propellers on top of this, and you can actually see the turbulence in the water, right? It's a machine, right? Now, you might say that these people are just nuts, along with me. But really, look, it's a set of chemical reactions. And you should just describe it and be done with it. And of course, the biologists know it's a set of chemical reactions. That's not really the point. They know the brain's made of neurons too, and that your computer is made of, you know, is made of atoms and quantum states, right? It's just not an interesting way to debug your programs, unless you have a quantum computer and you're writing quantum programs, but, you know, someday. So biologists want to model cells like machines in terms of processes taking place in them and how things move around and that sort of thing. The only thing is, they didn't build the machine. So they actually don't have the blueprints. So essentially, they're engaged not in engineering, but in reverse engineering. Exactly. Thank you. So essentially, they're doing reverse engineering. Right? And reverse engineering is much harder than engineering in some ways. And there are a bunch of reasons why that is. They're trying to create models. Now, if a model were a few simple differential equations, wouldn't be so bad, like the Chen model, right? I mean, we can imagine, they did the Chen model by hand, but we can imagine how to do the Chen model, right? You know, you search the space of all possible differential equations up to maybe 30, right, with all the parameters you have measured, and then you stick it all into MATLAB, and, you know, you're done. And by the spice, actually, this is what the spice people are doing. Excuse me. Unfortunately, I have to convince you that, you know, the systems can't be described in terms like that. And this is one reason why this will save the world. Okay? It's because it's clear that the creation of biological models is a symbolic computing task of enormous proportions. It's a symbolic computing task for three reasons. First, as I've been arguing, the models the biologists would like to see them compose are complex process dynamics and operating logics, which aren't easily captured in terms of these different equations. Of course, I'm not saying biological models shouldn't be formally represented. Okay, algebra, of course, is pure symbol manipulation, as we've all known since forever. But differential equations are a fairly simplistic symbolic representations compared with descriptions of what a subsystem of a complex machine is doing. Also, such equations range over the real values. Now, real values are great. Okay, real values are great, but they have this really ugly property, which is that they're continuous and infinite in all directions. All right. So the problem is you have to parameterize your model in real terms. And remember, no data. Okay, there's very little data relative to the number of equations and parameters you have to stick into the equations. Okay, so if you can get the parameters, great. But you basically aren't going to be able to get the parameters that you've got. So biologists are essentially not only trying to reverse engineer the system, they're trying to solve the n-body problem, where n is, I don't know, several million or something. Okay, with no data. So let's look at how hard this is. Let's take our friend Prochlorococcus, simple organism. Prochlorococcus has 1,700 genes. And all of these genes basically create one protein, right? Now, that's actually not true, as you were pointing out yesterday, of humans. Humans have, nobody really knows, but say 30,000 genes. And each of them creates like 10 proteins or 100 proteins. And there's all this really convoluted, complex operating logic. These guys don't have most of that stuff, okay? Fairly simple. Right, exactly. These are fairly simple. So all we need to do in order to get a model of this is to parameterize these 1,700 equations, right? It's easy. You just measure all the dynamics of a few thousand internal terms over a period of, say, a few cell cycles, maybe a week or so, at millisecond time scale, no problem. So, and you do that, say, 10 times, dump it all into MATLAB, and you're done, all right? Let me repeat that. Measure the dynamics of the internal terms, that is, all of the concentrations of all of the molecules, not just the genes. I mean, not just the proteins. At millisecond time scale, you mean measure all the concentrations of the small molecules. Do we know how to measure the concentration of even a single small molecule inside a cell? No. And it's not just the concentration of small molecules. It's their shapes and their conformations, their phosphorylation state, where they are. I mean, it's, you know, all kinds of stuff about it. Essentially, none of it can be measured. So, in fact, I just saw in the tech, what's that tech magazine that you have, JP, called? I was reading your magazine.
Tech Review.
They had last month, the month before or something, they had like the 10 hot tech. They always have the 10. All the 10 hot technologies are always different for some reason in that magazine. But anyway, so one of the hot technologies was metabolomics. Metabolomics is trying to do this problem, which is basically to measure, you know, sort of what's in your metabolism as opposed to just measuring gene expression or something like that. And they were saying this is, you know, one of the hot new technologies. Well, unfortunately, in the same issue, just to give you an idea of what the concept of hot technology was, you know, internet in airplanes. All right, so that was at the same level as metabolomics. I personally would put my money in internet on airplanes. It's probably going to happen before metabolomics. So this is the second reason why LISP, or more precisely symbolic computing, will save the world. It's because the range of the process models, that is what those models range over, can't possibly be entirely numeric. Right? They have to range over qualitative or symbolic or discrete or whatever term you want to use, values. And the trick, which we do not know how to do, is actually to get these things to interact, to be able to range over both numerical, where we have numbers, and non-numerical, where we don't have numbers, value spaces. people are working on this, it's just very difficult. Okay. So the range of the complex system, these systems are to a great degree symbolic. They're more like logics, sort of numerical logics in a sense. They're more like logics than they are like different sets of different equations. So we went out both qualitative and quantitative. I'll show you some examples of things that are approaches to this. None of these are very good approaches to this. This is a causal regulatory model, which essentially just talks about the up or down relationship without giving any numbers between different genes in the system, and it has very abstract terms. This actually ranges from, you know, DFR is the level of activation of some protein. There's some gene expression, and it's got like photosynthetic activity, right? All is one term, but that's the level at which we actually can measure. All right, so you know, this is a very abstract model, and it's meant to range. If you have numbers to put in this, great, but it can also essentially figure out the light. Figure out that if you increase the light, then you have to walk through it, basically. You increase the light, it's going to increase that, it's going to increase this. Whatever the numbers are, the ones are going to go up. Yeah, it's a sort of qualitative model. This is a model I got from Anil Malaparupu, who's at Harvard in the systems biology program. He's building a language called B, I have no idea why, that is actually written in a language that begins with L. And it is intended to model, it's also sort of part qualitative, part numerical, part discrete, part continuous. Often use qualitative, symbolic, and discrete together. They're actually slightly different, but anyway. And he's trying to model the positions of things. Actually, other people have done this. You model the positions of things and, you know, the phosphorylation state and that kind of thing. So, and if you have models like that, this is a simulation from a completely different model, actually. I just sort of grabbed a qualitative simulation of a biological system off the web somewhere. But you can see that you can, you know, do the sort of equivalent of the differential equation modeling. Actually, I'm just skipping these two. So, because they're just too complicated to talk about. Let's see. We're back to beta rest, because that's how I figure out where I am. There we go. So the cellular components signal one another by making conformational changes to one another. They attach little molecular gizmos to one another, which causes the carrier molecules to be recognized, etc. It's a machine. The description needs to be of a machine. So I've argued that biological models are fundamentally complex, combined qualitative and quantitative process models, that symbolic computing is necessarily going to be involved in their simulation. But now I want to talk a little more about the building of the models themselves beyond their simulation. A few minutes ago, I made some rather bold assumptions. I said the Prochlorococcus with 1,700 genes basically had no operating logic. Of course, it does have some operating logic. But how do we think we know? And I said we know what all these genes do, or just for the example. Well, how do we know what all these genes do? Right? You had asked. This is sort of a question you had asked. So, or somebody asked, what's the evidence for this? Well, it turns out that, of course, biology, like all sciences, is fundamentally collaborative. In fact, you're collaborating even if you don't know you're collaborating because, and this is the key phrase, biologists base their theories about what something does upon what other biologists think some other things that look similar do. Now, this sounds stupid, but all science works this way, right? And it's not. But the look similar is the key phrase here. And it isn't always true. Many biologists, and it's basically just a heuristic. So the heuristic is, if I have something that looks like hexokinase, and I don't have the evidence that it isn't hexokinase, then I'll just assume it's hexokinase. Well, what does it mean to look like hexokinase? It means that it kind of it's structurally similar to something else that somebody claimed was hexokinase. And that's all well and good, you know, then you can go test it, things like that. These are similarities. This is a clustering alignment of different hexokinases from different organisms. You can see that, like, sometimes it's the same. This is the amino acid sequence. Sometimes it has actually the same in a couple positions. Sometimes, you know, it's different at different levels. So, you know, nothing's ever exactly the same. It's all sort of almost the same, right? So, the problem is, they're never exactly the same, as I just said, for other genes. 70% alignment is pretty good, 70% similarity, okay? But how do we know that if you don't have some other evidence, how do I know that, suppose this is a calcium channel, that is something that goes inside the membrane and calcium goes through it, right? How do I know what level of similarity turns a calcium channel to a potassium channel? Answer, no one knows. Right? So you have to test it. Second, let's say they were 100% alike. Okay, so I found it's exactly alike. Well, but in the presence of some other thing going on that I don't know about, so this is actually this one's a potassium channel, this the potassic channel again from that PDB in the protein database. Remember I said push the button to get the confirmation, so this is what you get if you push the button. And you can rotate on it and stuff, it's irrelevant. So, you know, how many of these little things on the ends do I have to change before that thing transfers calcium instead of potassium? No one knows. I mean, you could do a bunch of experiments and find out. Right? Now, the problem is that even if they were 100% alike, there's other stuff going on. There are proteins, there are and other kinds of things that are like attached to the thing that you've got the model of. That this happens all the time. That you know their conformation changes the channel from one channel could change the channel from one doing one thing to doing another thing. Right? Here's an example where I don't actually know what's going on. I didn't read the description, but this is a very common thing. As a biologist, I can read off what's going on here. Essentially, when this set of you know of heterodynamic, they look homodynamic, homomeric. But in any case, when this set of gizmos is in this conformation, you know, then the channel is passing, and when it's in that conformation, the channel is closed, or the other way around, whatever's going on. So my channel could look exactly like your channel, but the thing that attaches to it, the context, the operating context, could be completely different, make completely different behavior. Now, biologists actually are aware of those two things, all right? And I don't think they realize how deep the problem is, but they're basically aware of those two things. There's a third thing that they're not aware of, or, you know, they're aware of and don't really care about, which comes back to this phrase, biologists base their theories about what something does upon what other biologists think something does, essentially, that looks similar. So what's the problem with that? What?
Bootstrap problem.
What do you mean by bootstrap problem? Yes, right. I'm a loser. You based your theory on me. Now you're a loser.
Okay. Circularly all correct.
Circularity aside, it's on a hill of sand, right? And the problem is that nobody's keeping track of provenance. So it's on a hill of sand, and that'd be fine as long as you know that somebody's pulled a kernel of sand out from under you. Right? Problem is you don't. Now, you might say, well, you know, provenance tracking isn't a very hard problem. Why, you know, they can just do it. All right? And in fact, Oracle could even do that. Right? In fact, you know, like, anything could do that. But the problem is deeper than that for the following reason. So, where am I? That's kind of the rest of this going. So if we were working on the same gene in the same organism, then we might be able to, you know, both put our names into like the CBS thing and NCBI, which doesn't exist. And I'd say, you know, and so you know all people working on the same thing. And, you know, that's a simple database problem. No problem. Okay. If we're working on the same gene or what we think is the same gene in different organisms, well, you can imagine, you could sort of imagine a way to do this. Still not AI, right? You know, like I say organism A and hexokinase, and you say organism B, and because you said hexokinase, I said hexokinase, and you can kind of track working the same thing. Alright? But you can get a little more complex. Alright? So now, the database has to know which genes are similar and that sort of thing, but that's not too bad. So I'm going to go one step further. What happens if we're working on the same subsystem? So I'm like working on glycolysis. Now, if we have a name for the subsystem, great, because then you can use the names. Right? You can see where this is going. Okay? But if the subsystems just sort of overlap a little bit, you know, how do we know we're working on the same subsystem? Well, that's a little harder problem. It's probably still not impossible, right? Where this gets really bad is when, in reverse engineering, we're sort of in the midst of trying to figure out what's going on, and we don't have controlled vocabularies, we don't know what's what, so you can't actually do model comparison, right? You can't tell when the provenance links have to be made, right? This is a fundamental problem because function, which is of course what I've been talking about, right? That is, people are talking about the function of these things. Function is a fundamentally poorly defined concept, right? The fiction of function. What's that phrase? I have another one, the myth of maps. The myth of map. In any case, the story of Sanders. The slander of statistics. So the problem is there's no agreed upon terminology. Right? And without an agreed upon terminology, you can't figure out what things are related to what. Because there's these big complicated models that, you know, somebody says, I have a quote. So somebody said, I got these two off things, describing the same thing. So one person said, trafficking in an acidified endosomal compartment, trafficking to an acidified endosomal compartment. And somebody else described it as engulfed and hydrolyzed in an organelle. Great. Okay. So now we're into a very difficult problem. Of analyzing function in a general way as controlled vocabulary. And this is fundamentally a semantics problem, right? It's not common sense because we have a relatively closed system, but it is fundamentally a semantics problem. Now, there are approaches to this. There are two approaches I'll talk about very briefly. One is the gene ontology, where a bunch of, I think, slightly crazy biologists have gotten together and decided they're going to figure out how to do representation, right? They haven't bothered to ask anybody who knows how to do representation how to do representation. So they're kind of doing this sort of quasi-broken representation. But at least they have the idea they need to control vocabulary and like hierarchy. And, you know, everything is an ontology these days, but most people don't know anything about ontology. But that's okay, because actually, you know, they'll get there. And the other approach I want to talk about is my favorite is this thing called view application. View application involves it's actually the theory was invented about mid-80s, and it's the equivalent for complex models. In fact, it was developed for talking about the way people do science. It's the equivalent for complex models of aspectual programming, which was developed in the mid-90s. So essentially, you have things called views, and you combine the views together, and you get more complex views, et cetera, and you can sort of map the views on top of each other, and they mix in the same way aspects are supposed to mix in. These are two pretty good approaches to that. So that problem, and people are starting to do that. Incidentally, view application is also an approach to the problem of how you actually, once you have the models that are similar, how you actually merge them into a single model. All right. So we have approaches to this kind of thing. So how else to save the world? So it is essentially symbolic computing that will enable biologists to compose and reason about complex models whose form and domain is essentially, at least in part, symbolic, and which must be matched in essentially symbolic terms. I'm reading this because it's a long, complicated sentence. To what amounts to essentially symbolically cast experimental results. And it's essentially symbolic computing that will enable biologists who are working on similar problems to find one another and to compare their work and the results and to keep track of this incredibly long sentence and changes in the field. And composition of complex models is essentially symbolic computing. So symbolic computing, conveniently here abbreviated with an L, is fundamental to biology. So, it's fundamental biology. So let's say, just hypothetically, I've convinced you all of that, right? So you might say, well, that's nice. So Lisp is going to, help the medical community, right? But how is that saving the world? How does that, rise to the level of the title of my talk, how it's going to save the world? Well, remember these little guys? So bacteria. In fact, phytoplankton. Plankton are things that float around the ocean. Remember ocean scum, right? Phytoplankton are photosynthetic things that float around in the ocean. Friend photosynthesis. It turns out that among processes, photosynthesis is by far the most important on Earth. As with any process, it has many functions. Remember, functions are very complex. Okay, but among them are creates oxygen, sinks carbon dioxide. Exactly. Okay. Also, it's the source of almost all the oil and coal we use. Right? In fact, probably the source of all the oil and coal we use. In fact, phytoplankton are probably the source of the oil we use. Bottom, base of the marine food chain, exactly. Nothing bigger than a single cell. And of course, if we're going to have theories about things, the first theory we're going to have closed dumb theories of are bacteria, but that's a side point. Nothing bigger than a single cell is truly environmentally important. And among the single cell organisms, Prochlorococcus is by far the most important organism on the planet. It creates over half the oxygen, as we were talking about. It creates over half the oxygen. It sinks over half the greenhouse gases. It's the base of the marine food chain. A single species of Prochlorococcus, whatever it was, is half the biomass in the ocean. Single species. Okay. It's the base of the marine food chain. One species of Prochlorococcus constitutes nearly half the ocean biomass. There's just that. Understanding how Prochlorococcus responds to environmental change is the most important scientific problem of our time. In order to do this, biologists must have tools for thought that are largely composed, like claim of symbolic computing machinery. It follows that symbolic computing, or something like it, some half-broken implementation of Lisp, is the most important scientific tool of our time and is likely to contribute significantly to saving the world. That is, of course, if the world wants to be saved. Any questions?
None.
He's laughing. A million questions. John.
Are you saying our future depends on the health of pond scum?
Absolutely. Oceans. Ponds are irrelevant. Oh. Oceans. Our future depends on ocean scum. Let me explain this a little bit. This is a NASA slide, which is from the EOS satellite. Actually, all it does is reads chlorophyll concentration, right? So you can see there's, a whole bunch of stuff on the Earth. So the green is like not chlorophyll. But the map is a little misleading because it looks like there's a lot of ground. And there's actually not a lot of ground. There's a lot of ocean. And all of these green parts in the ocean, which is like everything above about latitude 45, about us, and everything below about latitude 45 is essentially water and is essentially full of it. The top layer of the entire ocean, in fact, all throughout this, it is full of Prochlorococcus and other organisms. If you dip a tablespoon into the water anywhere, on average, anywhere, I'm sure you can find places this isn't true, but on average, you'll have as many Prochlorococcus, well, as many cyanobacteria, essentially, as probably there are people in the United States, and as many viruses as there are people on Earth. So essentially, everything is irrelevant except this. Other questions?
So pardon the ignorance, but it seems that biologists have hitherto been describing their problem domain sort of the way ancient Greek mathematicians talked about math, in terms of word problems, sort of. Am I understanding what you're saying correctly, in that you need...
Right. So I addressed that in a part that probably went by too quickly. The whole thing went by too quickly. I basically said that you could just turn it all into chemical reactions, right? But that's actually not a useful thing to do for a bunch of reasons in the second half of the talk. Right? So you could say, well, actually, you know, what they really mean is that's a saying, ribosome drags DNA through, whatever it drags, RNA through the, you know, through itself, is actually this whole set of differential equations of chemical reactions, right? But that would be really stupid. Right. There's a bunch of reasons that'd be really stupid, and that's actually kind of a second half of the talk. But I can talk to you offline about if you want to go into it a little bit more. I have one more question, then I promised to give someone else a few minutes, and I'm out of around, so go ahead.
I have two quick ones. One is, in these models, do you see, along the lines of Gabriel's talk last night, principles that might be usable by the programming community in creating different kinds of systems?
You know, yeah, it's an interesting question. Like Gabriel's talk last night was, I thought, kind of wild, which is fine, but also very interesting in that way. I hadn't thought about that before last night, because I think about it the other way, right? Yeah. You know, biologists using the computer technology.
Having a couple very simple systems like this worked out, you know, in the programming language.
Well, you know, these systems ain't simple. That's part of the kind of problem with Gabriel's theory, is that these systems are incredibly complex compared to anything you've written.
Just pick the simplest one first, and we'll do that. The other question had to do with language, because I worked with a group, I was doing proteomics, and I found it, I like your recommendations as to people in this kind of audience trying to do work in this area.
Yeah.
There's just so much terminology and things that, you know, biochemistry concepts that they just understand, you know, automatically, and you have no idea what they're talking about or what the importance of it is.
Caltrain. So I was active, just like all of you, right? And I decided I was going to become a molecular biologist. Just decided this was the most important problem there was. I'm going to become a molecular biologist. Now, Gabriel paid somebody to go along with this. I don't know what the story was. No one was paying me to do it, but in any case, so I had a job at a startup in San Francisco, and I picked up, there's a stack about this high of books, right, that you need in order to take biochemistry, some like the biology GRE, right? You go to the bookstore here, and you start on page one, and you get on Caltrain, and you go to the city, it's an hour, and you get to about page 10. Then you like get on the train after, and it's 20, you do that for about a year and a half, and then you take the GRE, and then you walk into a lab. The important part is walking into a lab. You walk into a lab and you say, I'm a programmer. I'll work for you for free for a year if you let me play in your lab. What are they going to say? No. It's not, you know, I'll talk about this afternoon, but it turns out that, so there was another talk sort of related to this vaguely this afternoon, but it turns out that becoming a biologist is a lot, being a biologist is a lot easier than being a programmer. By far and away. There's a lot of terminology, but, you know. Anyway, I have to. Let's do it. All right, thank you.